George Yeager never would have suspected what was going to happen to his family. George Yeager took his three sons and his own father out on a boating trip. A storm came up, the waves became ferocious, the craft began to fill with water and to sink. George and his three sons and father all put on their life jackets, tied a rope around each one and extended it between each person and jumped into the ocean and began to swim toward the shoreline. But the waves were too high and too strong, and George Yeager had to watch one by one each of his sons and his father sink beneath the waves. But the youngest son, who was the first to go, set the atmosphere and the attitude and the spirit for all the others who were about to die. When he said to his father, "Dad, I can't go on fighting. I'd rather be with Jesus." What a tribute to the courage and the testimony of that young boy. But it is not only a tribute to his hope in Jesus Christ, it is also a tribute to the instruction of a father who taught his son how to deal with the eventualities of life, but who also taught him to deal with the eventuality of death. This morning we are thinking about the effective father. And we want to think about the effective father in two ways. First, we will consider the need for effective fathering, and then we will consider the challenge of effective fathering as we think about some principles for fathers. I know that we're not addressing everyone in particular this morning, but I think some of what we have to say will apply to mothers and grandparents, since this is also Grandparent Appreciation Day, and we do love you and appreciate you. And it also pertains to children. Young people, I challenge you that you take notes on what we talk about today, and then after the service this afternoon or sometime this week, you talk to your father about these particular principles. The need for effective fathering. Fatherhood is the single greatest opportunity that a man has to impact the lives of other people. When he takes trial lumps of clay and he molds these lumps of clay, his children, into those values and that perspective that he wants to impress upon his children, he is not only developing his children, but also his children's children and his children's children's children and all the relatives and all the friends in between. That is the single greatest impact that a man normally will have in his life. Ours, however, is not a day of effective fathering. It is rather a day of faulty fatherhood. One aspect of faulty fatherhood is the problem of the silent father. By that I mean that father who is willing to refer and defer to either his wife's leadership or to an educational system or even to the Church of Christ or to the peers of his children to provide the values and the leadership for his family. The silent father. But there is also the problem of the absent father. The father who simply is not there. He is not there to guide and to direct and to shape and to mold. Perhaps he has his priority system as such, a night out with the boys, or sports has taken up his commitment, or his own particular hobbies, or he is related to another problem of fatherhood, and that is the career father, the successful father. I mean the one who, at the sacrifice and the expense of his own family and children, is after his own successful career and prosperity. He wants to make money. The absent father. There was a song a few years ago which reflected on the absent father, and perhaps some of you heard that. It was called Cats in the Cradle. Let me read a few lines. My child arrived just the other day. He came to the world in the usual way, but there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away, and he was talking for I knew it, and he grew. He'd say, "I'm going to be like you, Dad. You know I'm going to be like you." And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon. "When you coming home, Dad?" "I don't know when, but we'll get together then. You know we'll have a good time then." My son turned 10 just the other day. He said, "Thanks for the ball, Dad. Come on, let's play." "Can you teach me to throw?" I said, "Not today. I've got a lot to do." He said, "That's okay." And he walked away, but his smile never dimmed, and said, "I'm going to be like him. Yeah, you know I'm going to be like him." I've long since retired. My son's moved away. I called him up just the other day. I said, "I'd like to see you if you don't mind." He said, "I'd love to, Dad, if I can find the time. You see, my new job's a hassle and the kids have the flu. But it's sure nice talking to you, Dad. It's been sure nice talking to you." And as I hung up on the phone, it occurred to me, he'd grown up just like me. My boy was just like me. And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon. "When you coming home, son?" "I don't know when, but we'll get together then. You know we'll have a good time then." What a sad commentary. And yet how we have put our stamp of approval upon a lifestyle which agrees with the absent father, the successful father. Newsweek magazine carried an article about a great industrialist, Herr Friedrich Flick. When he died, his personal fortune was $1.5 billion. But Newsweek magazine made this astounding comment, a secular magazine, mind you. It said this, "But for all his enormous power and wealth, the old man had one human shortcoming. He could not control his family." In the eyes of our standard of success, this man was super successful. But I want to tell you something, dads. This man was a failure. And he was a failure of the profoundest sort. Ours is a day of faulty fatherhood. It's not only a day of that, though. It is also a day when our children have such tremendous pressures and influences in their own lives and upon their minds. I read somewhere that the highest suicide rate in our country is among high school teenagers. Did you know that? I also heard that the 50% of the automobile accidents in America are occasioned by teens who are drunk. Let me know just a few of the influence and the pressures upon your young people. One, we might call the myth of materialism. That is the principle that our young people have picked up. And it's true in Gadsden, Alabama, and it's true in the First Presbyterian Church. This is the principle that a man's happiness is intimately connected to the number of possessions he possesses. But Jesus Christ said that a man's life does not consist in the number of possessions which he has. But where are they getting that idea of happiness? From television? From the school system? From their peers? I suggest that the first place they're getting it is from their fathers. The myth of materialism. But there is also another pressure. And that one we may call the manipulation of the media. While we were on vacation, I asked my children to take notes one Saturday morning while they were watching cartoons on each commercial that came on. And they were to write down the product that was being advertised on TV. And after several hours and some 40 to 50 commercials, a full 25 of those commercials had to do with convincing children that they needed a certain food product. Particularly, McDonald's and Hubba Bubba. Now, I like McDonald's and sometimes Hubba Bubba. But the point is, advertising is structured in such a way to manipulate the minds of adults and young people to convince you that in order to be a happy, well-rounded, fully successful, okay person, you have got to have this product. You've got to eat this way. You have to wear these clothes. You have to talk in this way. You have to go to a certain school. But it's worse than that, friends. It's worse than that. We also did something else. Huh. And we have a rule that we'll do this whenever anybody wants to watch a new television program. We're going to evaluate that program. And so we sat down and watched several programs. One was Love, Sydney, The Facts of Life, and another filthy one called Filthy Rich. And we evaluated those. I'm talking to dads primarily. Dad, in a subtle, in a warm, cute way, some of these programs were arguing for and permitting illicit sex relationships and accepting homosexuality as a normal alternate lifestyle. And one of them even made fun of traditional Christian values which opposed that lifestyle. dead? That is what? By subtle way is being dumped into your child's mind. I am not against television. I enjoy television. I watch television in moderation. But men, it is our responsibility to make sure that that happens which is said about computers, G-I-G-O, garbage in, garbage out. Does not happen also to your children. And you, Dad, are primarily responsible to make sure that it doesn't happen. Because to some extent, your young people are not yet capable of evaluating the philosophical, theological, moral implications of what is coming across. There's another pressure. I said there is the pressure of the myth of materialism, of the manipulation of the media, and there is the obvious pressure called peer pressure upon your child. I am told that chickens in a chicken yard have a pecking order. Did you know that? I didn't know that. That confusion reigns in a chicken yard until all the chickens know the relationship that they have to the main chicken pecker. The same is true with your teenagers, but I want to say on another level, the same is true among adults, how they relate and how you relate to everybody else in the pecking order. The two most influential needs that your young people are out to get. One is popularity, and the other one is acceptance. Do you know where they're getting it, fathers? They're getting it from you. They're getting it from some other peer. Are they getting it off the walls? Graffiti in bathrooms? Where is it coming from? Well, let's talk now about some principles for effective fathering. I said today is not an era of effective fathering, and today is an era of tremendous influences and pressures upon our young people. But before I go on, I want to say this. Dad, do you want to be an effective father? If you want to be an effective father, there is one absolute qualification that you have to realize, and it is this. You have to be willing to submit yourself completely to God. Now, that may sound over-spiritual to you, but that is the key to effective fathering. Will you pray, Lord, I want to be an effective father. You grandfathers, mothers, you can change it to suit you. But will you pray right now? I'm not going to stop, but in your own heart of hearts, as we're talking and thinking, will you pray, Lord, make me an effective father? Now, let's consider some principles for effective fathering. This is the challenge. The first principle is this. If you are an effective father, it is because you are the pace setter in your home. Do you know what a pace setter does? I don't care too much about automobile racing and stock car races and on down the line. At one time I did, now I don't. I think it is one of the biggest waste of machine, of manpower, of energy, and of gasoline. But I know Tom Perky likes it, so I give him his right to enjoy it. But a pace setter is that car which gets out in front of the race cars and he sets the pace for all the cars to be hummed and ready to go. And when the pace is set, he pulls off and all the other cars go zooming by. The father is to be the pace setter in his home. That means that an effective father must be the model of Christian experience in his life. What does that mean? That means that he must be walking in obedience to Jesus Christ himself. He must have a time when he meets God daily in prayer. He must have a time when he is reading the Word of God daily. He must be faithful in his attendance upon the Word of God. He must be faithful in his responsibilities if he is an elected official of Christ's church. It is an awesome responsibility. Ladies, don't think that because you have been exhorted to be in submission to your husbands that you have the short end of the stick and that you have the worst part and that you have the heaviest load. I want to tell you, as I was telling a young couple in premarital counseling yesterday morning, that it is the father and the husband who has to bear the burden and the load and the responsibility to walk into obedience to God, because God will hold him responsible. It takes courage to be an effective father, Dad. It takes courage to say no. No to the influences in your home and no to other influences outside of your home. And it takes faith in God to be the leader that God intends, not preachers, not theologians, but every single man who becomes a father to be. An effective father is not only a model of Christian experience, he also sees his home as a classroom. I don't mean a stuffy academic experience. I mean in the midst of fixing bicycles and putting planes and automobiles together and taking the family on outings and trips. He sees it all as an opportunity to be shaping these lumps of clay into that image which they ought to be shaped into. Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9. Moses was telling the people of Israel and quoting to them the law of God. He said, when you get into the country, into your land, then you teach these principles diligently to your children. What a responsibility. Then he goes on to say, talk of them when you're in the way. Talk about them while you're sitting, while you're lying down, while you're walking along the road. Talk about these and put them on the doorpost of your home. Put reminders on the walls of your home and on the mantle in your home and in your kitchen that this home is dedicated to one purpose, and that is in obedience to Jesus Christ. We will be a home which pace is set by Him, and not by the dictates and the impulses of a father or of a mother, but Christ. He leads in devotions, the effective father. I mean, he doesn't wait for his wife to nag him to finally have prayer, but he says, children, come on. He brings his family together and he says, it's time to go to Sunday school and to go to church. It's time for us to be involved in some kind of active Christian ministry. He provides good music for his children. He provides good reading material for his children. An effective father is first and foremost, and I underscore this, a loving husband. I'm sure you've heard that before. The greatest thing that you can do for your child is to love your spouse. You see, the love, stability, respect, and the good communication that exists between a husband and wife is the single greatest security motivator for your child. Do you want to know what makes them feel good and right and secure? It is when they know that their mom and their dad are in love and their home is stable. The second main principle that I have is this. If you are an effective father, it is because you provide for your children. Now, the Bible says that a man who does not provide for his own family is worse than an infidel. It is a terrible thing for a man to be lazy and not to work. He will be judged for it, and he is worse than an infidel. But provision is more than just material provision, friends. I had a wife one time in my office, and she was complaining about the way she was being treated, and well, she should. But in the course of conversation, she made this comment, "But my husband is a good provider." I thought to myself, "Bull, what are you doing sitting here? If your husband is a good provider, talking to me." You see, provision is not merely in matter of material. Good provision is much more than that. If a father is a good father, he will provide for his family by ordering his priorities. What are those priorities? God, wife, children, church, job. He will also be sensitive to his children's needs. Do you know your children, Dad? I mean, do you know your children's needs? Do you know their needs physically? Do you know their needs emotionally and spiritually? Do you really understand what their needs are? Let me give you three books that I would recommend, and don't depend on your wife to say, "Now, what were those books that the preacher said?" You take your pen and you write them down, and you become responsible to follow through and being the father that you should be. Three books I want to recommend that would help you be the father that you can be. The first one is this: The Spirit-Controlled Family by Tim LaHaye. The second book is entitled The Effective Father by Gordon MacDonald, and his material, some of it, I am sharing with you today. And then there's another book by Dr. Ross Campbell, who is a Christian, a psychiatrist, right up here in Chattanooga, who wrote two books. One, How to Really Love Your Child, and the second one is How to Really Love Your Teenager. You need to read those, Dad. And if you don't read them, then you are short-circuiting your responsibility and your opportunity to be a great dad and a great father. I said that he will be sensitive to his children's needs. I have absolutely no idea what time it is. Jim, what time is it? He said it was 12:02. If you won't look at your watch, I won't ask him again what time it is. And let's spend at least 5 minutes and going through some of these other principles, okay? I said that being a good provider means that you will be sensitive to your children. Firstly, that means sensitivity means time. By that I mean if you are going to be an effective father, it's going to take time. There are no two ways about it. I was impressed with a father in Montgomery, Alabama, who could not go on a family trip with his family, but he sat down with them, he planned the trip, and he worked out all the details, where they would be camping along the West Coast, where they would be at a certain period of time, and after they left, he finished his work early. He caught a plane, flew to California, rented a car, and he drove out on a lonely stretch of highway. And he hid the car and he stood out on the side of the road because he knew his family would be driving by anytime. And there he was, hitchhiking as his family drove by. Boy, that was a father. What do you think those children are going to remember about their dad when they think about him? Boy, he was interested in me. He was willing to give up and to give time for us. But sensitivity also means something else. It means no busy signals, Dad. Not right now. Let me get through doing this and then I'll listen to you. Don't bother me. Let me finish reading the paper. Will you go do something else? Busy signals. Do you know that you probably spend more time trying to keep your children from interrupting you than you would spend if you just stopped and listened for a few minutes? No busy signals. Dr. Ross Campbell said that young people, children, teens need what he calls focused attention. By that he means give them direct personal attention yourself, but also eye contact. Have you ever noticed that a small baby cries and its eyes are darting around until it finally fixes upon the area where its mother's voice is coming from? And a sense of comfort, of security takes place. You ought to make it a practice to look your children right square in the pupil, Dad, from time to time without necessarily making them self-conscious of the fact. Because at some point they're going to say, "Don't look at me!" Focused attention. Time, no busy signals. Tim LaHaye said in preparing his book on homosexuality that he determined that the main cause of homosexuality was a rejecting father. A judge reported that of the some hundreds of juvenile cases that he had had to come into his court, he had never had one case where there was a father who took his son fishing or who spent time with his son in a regular activity. Sensitivity means discipline. The book of Proverbs says, "He who spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves his child chasteneth him betimes." Did you know Dr. Spock apologized in 1974? He said, "Mothers, I was wrong about discipline. You better take the rod back out of the closet and begin to discipline your children again because it's not working." Not disciplining then. Sensitivity means love and affection. In the back of every child's mind, there is one question. Whether they're a teen or whether they're a young person, there is a question which is unspoken and they may not even be conscious of it. Let me tell you what it is. Do you love me? Do you love me? And affection, touching. I don't have many memories of my father, but I have one that stands out in my mind, and that was when I was a child afflicted with what was then a terminal disease of spinal meningitis. I got to the point where I couldn't walk. I had to go to the hospital for several weeks. I can remember my father picking me up and literally carrying me in his arms to the hospital. In spite of the fact that I felt terrible and it was awful and the fever was excruciating, it felt good to be in these big, strong, brawny arms. That was more security to me than all the doctors in the hospitals in the world. Affection. Sensitivity. Finally, let me say this. We're skipping one principle, and maybe we can come back to it at some time. I'm talking to dads. 16 Christians were in a Bible study, and we are concluding. 16 Christians in a Bible study were asked this question. What was your father? What was your father? One said, my father was a loving, great guy. Another said, I really never knew my father that well. Listen, not one person immediately responded by saying something about his father's profession, his father's possessions, or his father's position in life. Dad, if I were to go through this congregation this morning and ask your young person and ask your teen, what is your father? How would they answer me? What would you like them to say?